Me too. Mark chapter 3, the first 12 verses of Mark chapter 3. Everyone found it? This passage has parallel passages that appear to be the same event in Matthew and in Luke. What I'd like for us to do, now that you found Mark, is to go to Matthew about that. We're going to read Matthew's account of this and then Luke's account and come back to Mark last. And this will give you an idea of the perspective that each of these writers is giving us. They give a little different information. And putting them all together, you can kind of see what perhaps happened there. So let's go to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, verses 9 through 14. It says, "And when he," talking about Jesus, "was departed thence, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man which had his hand withered. And they asked him, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath days? That they might accuse him. And he said unto them, What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into the pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. Then said he to the man, Stretch forth your hand. And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole, like as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him." Now, if you would flip over to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6, verses 6 through 11. Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, it says, "And it came to pass also on another Sabbath that he entered into the synagogue and taught. And there was a man whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and Pharisees watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts and said to the man which had the withered hand, Rise up and stand forth in the midst. And he arose and stood forth. Then Jesus said unto them, I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil? To save life or to destroy it? And looking round about upon them all, he said to the man, Stretch forth your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And they were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus." Now, if you would, turn to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3, verses 1 to 12. Actually, it's verses 1 to 6 tell the story, but we're going to go and cover through verses 12, so we'll keep reading. Mark chapter 3, verse 1, "And he entered again to the synagogue, and there was a man there which had a withered hand. And they watched him, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. And he said unto the man which had the withered hand, Stand forth. And he said unto them, Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days or to do evil? To save life or to kill? But they held their peace. And when he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man, Stretch forth your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole as the other. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. But Jesus withdrew himself with his disciples to the sea. And a great multitude from Galilee followed him, and from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and from beyond Jordan. And they about Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, when they had heard what great things he did, came unto him. And he spake to his disciples that a small ship should wait on him because of the multitude, lest they should throng him. And for he had healed many, insomuch that they pressed upon him for to touch him. As many as had plagues and unclean spirits, when they saw him, fell down before him and cried, saying, Thou art the Son of God. And he straitly charged them that they should not make him known. I'm going to talk to you this morning about the practice of discernment. We see Jesus doing several things in these 12 verses that give us a little insight into his thinking, the way he thinks. And I want to tell you three lessons that I think we can learn from this text. The first one, if you've got an outline, is this. Recognize the value and obligations of time, opportunity, and responsibility. A lot of blanks there. Let me say that again. Recognize the value and obligations of time, opportunity, and responsibility. Now, in that statement, I'll just look at the statement for a minute. And it says to recognize two things. Recognize two things, value and obligations. To recognize these two things about three things. The three things being time, opportunity, and responsibility. So you've got recognize two things about three things. Now you could break that apart and take them one at a time and make application to them in a multitude of ways. For instance, take the last three things, just take the first one, time. That statement says recognize the value and obligations of time. Now take those two things and use them one at a time. Recognize the value of time. The second thing, recognize the obligations of time. Then you could take the second one of the last three and break it apart with the first two, and you would have recognize the value of opportunity. Recognize the obligations of opportunity. You see that? So you could make six sentences and six thoughts with that one statement. Now, I'll just give you an example of how that could be applied. Suppose, for instance, that Don Tibbett was a multimillionaire. You have to imagine, pretty vivid imagination to see that, don't you, Don? Let's imagine that he's a multimillionaire, and he wants to hire me to invest some of his money. Now, that takes even more imagination, doesn't it? So let's say that he takes $15 million and gives it to my disposal and says, I want to invest in, one thing I want to invest in is some land. So I want you to be on the lookout and actively pursue some land that might be at a bargain price, and here's $15 million that's at your disposal to look out for this and to buy it for me. So we make arrangements, and that's what we're going to do. Well, Don is reading the paper one day, and he sees this land auction that's coming up. There's 100 acres going to be auctioned off, and so he calls me and says, hey, John, here may be an opportunity. Why don't you check that out? He said, I'd be willing to pay up to $2,000 an acre for this land. So a week or so goes by, and he somehow notices and finds out that land sold at this auction for $1,500 an acre. So what does he assume?
That I bought it.
Because he's willing to pay up to $2,000 an acre. So he calls me and says, did I get the land? I said, well, no, I just didn't make it over there. I just didn't make it to the auction. You know, I just didn't get there. Now, here is opportunity, first of all. There is opportunity to perhaps buy this land. And not just opportunity, but I had obligation to try to take advantage of the opportunity. Right? To see how the statement works. Now, I want you to think some things about Jesus and what Jesus is doing, the way Jesus perhaps is thinking in these 12 verses, sort of in line with that statement, Jesus goes to Jerusalem. He's in a synagogue, apparently in Jerusalem, we assume. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this a little later on, but there has already come a point where it is in becoming increasingly dangerous for Jesus to be in Jerusalem. We're going to talk about this a little further on down in the third point, I believe. But he's there. Jesus is there. Why is he there? I'm not sure. But I would propose to you that Jesus is there because he knows there is opportunity. He knows that his time is to be valued. How much time did Jesus have on this earth to do whatever God it was that God designed and purposed for him to do? Not a lot. 30, 33 years or so. Something like that. His ministry, it seems, you hear normally it's 3 years or 3.5 years, something like that. So his time was limited. How do you think Jesus spent his time? What we have is the record. If the record is an accurate indication of how Jesus spent all the rest of his time that's not recorded for us, he didn't appear to waste a lot of it, did he? He understood the value of time, the obligations of time, of opportunity that came his way. And for whatever reason, he goes back to Jerusalem and is in the synagogue. And there he sees a man with a withered hand. Some have suggested that this man was planted there simply for this test and to try to put Jesus in the spot. I don't know if that's the case. It doesn't matter. He was there and Jesus was there. A man with a withered hand. Now here is a point I want to make to you, is that a person in this condition, any of us, have an obligation, a simple obligation, to show mercy and compassion to someone who is in the condition that this man is in. You don't have to be taught that. Your conscience tells you that. How many times have I seen, perhaps you have seen as well, someone, especially in school. I remember this boy that was in, we moved to Heber Springs when I was in seventh grade. Seventh grade was my first year at school, and there was a boy in my class that was, we called him retarded, mentally handicapped. Pretty big, chubby kid. He was mocked to no end. You know how it is. I don't ever remember participating in making fun of this kid. I just didn't do it. Maybe it's the way I was taught, but there's something that just was repulsive about taking advantage of someone in that situation. And I wasn't a holy Joe, but I'll tell you, I was in the minority. There were a lot of kids that mocked him and ridicule him. But the thing I don't ever remember doing was coming to his defense. I may not have mocked him, but I stood on the sidelines and watched it go on. And I'm not sure that's a whole lot better. But there's something within us that we know better than to take advantage of someone who we can easily take advantage of, isn't there? But for me, and I don't know if you're this way or not, Sometimes I am just uncomfortable around situations like that. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And so what is the easiest thing to do?
Nothing.
Turn my head and ignore it. Look the other way instead of being compassionate and being a friend or whatever the case may be. We are taught, or we should have been taught, not to take advantage of children, for men not to take advantage of women. I can remember a number of years ago, I was in State Farm Insurance in town. I don't know if Susan was with me or not. Something like somebody was with me. I was in the lobby there conducting my business at State Farm Insurance and heard a commotion going on outside. So I looked out the door and there's about three females and three males that had just kind of blowed out this apartment that's across the street over there. And they're out in the street fighting. And that's what I heard was the commotion they were making. You know what my first inclination was, my split-second thought? Was to get in a position where I could watch, but they wouldn't know I was watching. All right? A little while later, I had the thought, I need to watch for a better reason than that. Watch to see that some of these guys don't start beating these females. And it was in the summertime. It would actually end up being one woman fighting with one man. And I mean, she was getting after. She didn't need me to come to her defense, I'll tell you. And I was as far away from her as I am to Marshall back there in the back. And I could see on the side of his face, right here on his cheek and partly on his neck, I could see as plain as day, four fingers and a thumb and a palm where she had slapped him and just left a handprint right there. Red streaks up and down his chest and his back marks. She was working him over. And to his whatever y'all would say, the guy was not fighting back. He was backing off. He was keeping his cool. He was not retaliating and hitting her. But what would I have done if he had? You know, you ought to be cautious, or at least I think so, about butting in to a married man's domestic disputes. That's you're treading on dangerous ground when you interfere into a family's disputes. But what would I do if I saw this man get her on the ground and start beating on her? I tell you what I would have done. I'd have went out there and tried to stop it somehow, married or not married. I might have ended up worse than she was, I don't know. But there's just something in me, in our conscience, not just mine, but yours as well, that wants to put a stop to abuse. That tells us that this is not right. That mercy and compassion is what ought to be shown to these people. And here Jesus is in the synagogue. There's a man there with a withered hand, a man that anybody that's in the synagogue ought to be able to look at that man and know, I should be merciful to that man. I should look upon him with opportunities to help him. Jesus has the opportunity. He is there. Maybe he was there that day for no other reason than that. I don't know. But he was there. The opportunity was there. The second point is this, that acts of mercy may be at one and the same time acts of judgment. Acts of mercy may be at one and the same time acts of judgment. Do you think this man's condition would have been any worse than If Jesus had waited till tomorrow? Probably not. Jesus could have ignored him and waited and got this man just the next day when it wasn't the Sabbath. He could have waited a day. He had a withered hand for who knows how long, unless there's something there we don't know. Jesus could have waited and avoided this confrontation. He could have looked the other way, but he didn't. He's there. The man is there in need. And Jesus knows what's fixing to take place if he heals this man's hand, doesn't he? He knows. He knows what's going to happen. So what does he do? He says, stand up. He doesn't get him off to the corner. He doesn't get him in one of the counseling rooms off to the side. He says, stand up right here where everyone can see, where it's going to be obvious. You're right here in the midst. Everyone's going to know what's going on. Everyone's going to be able to see it. And then he asks some questions. I'll tell you, in my mind, this is a courtroom. This is a courtroom with a prosecutor, a defense attorney, a jury, and a judge. And Jesus is standing there, and he begins to ask questions. Now, how does Jesus ask the questions? Have you ever seen those pictures of Jesus in the Bible story books? And he's standing there, real peaceful and serene looking, and maybe there's a little halo over his head, and he may have his arms out like this or something. You think Jesus said, in kind of a monotone, soft voice, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? I don't think so. I don't think so. Jesus stands there, has the man in their midst. And this is how I think it happened. I don't know this. This is how I think. He's in their midst, and he walks to one of the Pharisees, and he points at him, where there's no doubt who he's talking to. What do you think? Do you think it is good to do evil on the Sabbath or to do good? Piercing eyes. What does the man do? His lips are zipped. He is on the spot, isn't he? So Jesus goes to another one. He says, hey, the cat's apparently got your buddy's tongue. Maybe you'd like to answer for him. What do you think? What do you think? Would it be good to heal on the Sabbath or to do evil? What's the answer? No answer. And Jesus says, what is wrong with you? If you had a sheep and he was in the ditch, would you not pull him out? Would you? Is your sheep more important than this man's hand? Stretch forth your hand. And he heals him. That's a courtroom. What is the verdict? Condemnation. Jesus' act of mercy in healing this man at the same time condemns these people. Exposes them for what they are, and everyone sees it. Everyone understands what has just happened. There are, that I know of, three instances in the New Testament where I have heard it said that there was evidence that Jesus was a sinner. One of them that's totally unrelated to this is the Lord's Prayer, where it is said, Jesus, the Lord's Prayer says, forgive us, talking to the Father, our Father which art in heaven, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Jesus asking forgiveness of the Father. How do you answer that charge? Somebody tell me.
He had been asked how to pray.
Right.
He was teaching them.
That's right. Jesus, this is not a prayer of Jesus. The disciples asked Jesus, teach us how to pray. And Jesus said, here is the way you ought to pray. Our Father which art in heaven goes through the Lord's Prayer. See that? If these people would just read, that's not an admission of Jesus' sinfulness, is it? The second one is where Jesus, in anger, drives the money changers out of the temple. And it's real related as far as the type of sin as this one. The third one is right here. Jesus being angry. But is this a sin? Let me show you the difference between how someone who would claim that Jesus sinned here, how they approach this subject, and the difference in the way I approach it. For someone to say that Jesus sinned here, that his anger was wrong, he should not have done it, here's how they have to approach it. They're not going to tell you this, but it's easy to see. They're in their argument, here is the first premise. I can tell and understand what constitutes a sinful anger. I can look at a situation and I can correctly analyze it and tell you if this is wrong or not. That's premise number one. Premise number two, from this person's perspective, is I have examined the evidence, and there is enough evidence in the scriptures there of what happened that I can determine that, yes, Jesus should not have done this. It was a wrong anger. So what conclusion do they come to? Jesus is a sinner. I can tell the difference, and it was not legitimate anger, therefore Jesus sinned. Now I want you to notice the radical different way that I approach that. The Bible says, here's my first premise, that Jesus is without sin. Jesus was spotless and undefiled. There was no guile in him at all. His thoughts were pure, his motives were pure, his actions were pure. Everything about him was sinless, without spot, without blemish. That's my first premise. The Bible tells me that. My second premise is there's something happened here in Mark chapter 3 where Jesus got angry. I have some information about it, but it doesn't make a hoot to me what happened. Jesus did not sin. I don't know what the anger was about. I don't know how it looked, how it felt. I don't know anything about it. The only thing I know about it was not sin. Because my first premise is Jesus did not sin. So what did happen? And how do you explain that? I've spent the last few days trying to find all I could find about common writers that might would write on this subject and comment on this passage, trying to get some insights as how to articulate what I feel like is going on here. And there's not, every time you read about someone that writes a commentary on the book of Mark, they just skirt right over this and go on. There's nothing that I have seen there. I think a good book to write would be a commentary on things that other writers skirt over. And I've been trying to think of how it is that I might that we could look at this and explain this. And here's an explanation I want to give you. Let's suppose that I've got a grandson. His name is Jimmy. And Jimmy is in the room here with us. And it's been raining, and all this where we've been clearing out here on the side is just like it is right now, probably just muddy. And Jimmy looks out that door, and he sees some geese back over there in the back of our property there. And he says, "Papa, I want to run, go see the birds." And he opens the door, and he takes off out there. And I say, "No, come back, Jimmy, you're going to get in the mud. Don't go out there." And he just ignores me. He says, "No, I want to go see the birds." So he takes off. And I go out there and get him. And I catch him. And I pick him up. He's kicking and screaming. And I bring him back in here. And he's "I want to see the birds. I want to see the birds." And he's kicking. And he's getting mud all over my britches. And I bring him in here. And I look at you and I say, "Isn't he cute?" Right? What is Jimmy's crime in that instance? Disobedience, right? He disobeyed what I told him to do. Now, this is going to be the same crime. Let's suppose instead of looking out that door, he's looking out this door. And he sees the pretty birds in the field across the road. He says, "Papa, I want to go see the birds." And he opens the door and takes off running across there. He's 3 or 4 years old. And I say, "No, Jimmy, come back. No, I want to go see the birds." And I see he's not even paying attention to the highway. He's not even looking. And so I take off after him. And cars are zooming by. And I see he's getting closer and closer. And I am running as hard as I can to catch him. And finally, as he gets in the bottom of that ditch, I reach out and grab him. And I pick him up. And he's kicking and screaming, "I want to go see the birds." What do I do then? Let me tell you what I think I would do. All right? I would say, "Did you not hear me? I said, come back here. Get in here and sit down right there and don't get up until I tell you to. Don't slouch down in the seat. Sit up straight. No, you're not going to your Nana. You're staying right here. Shut up that crying or I'll give you something to cry about." I learned that one from my dad. What is the difference between that this crime is the same? Disobedience. What is the difference between my response there and here? Fear. I was scared to death. And you might say, "You probably scared him to death." I hope so. I hope I scared him. I hope he is shook up. And when my adrenaline quits rushing through my body and I calm down, I'll go back and we'll talk about this. But right now, I am angry. Because I'm scared. Now, I don't think that exactly fits with what Jesus was experiencing. But there have been times when I have seen people destroying their lives. And I see them acting like fools. And I become angry. Not so much at them personally, but at the result that I see is fixing to tear things apart in their lives and in their families. And I think that perhaps maybe what Jesus is experiencing, he can look at the Pharisees and he can say with anger, righteous anger, can you not see how the hardness of your heart is destroying your soul? I don't know. But I do know that when Jesus healed this man, those people were condemned. And their condemnation was seen by everyone that was there. And what did they do? They went out and got in cahoots with people that they hated. The only thing that they had in common with the Herodians was something that they would conjure up and try to convince the Herodians that this Jesus was out to usurp the throne of Herod. And so they have this common ground of trying to destroy Jesus for totally different reasons. They would have hated these people otherwise. But their hatred for Jesus is so great that they will work with people they despise in order to destroy him. Then the third thing is a wise man can see when danger is ahead and avoid it. Now, I told you we'd come back to this. But this might be a good project if some of you are Bible students, Bible scholars. And I think it's something I'm going to try to do if I can remember to do it and just take the time to do it, is to go through the Gospels individually and find you a map of Judea and the Sea of Galilee and all that area around that area there, from the Mediterranean Sea over east of the Jordan River. And north and south, you get all the area where Jesus might have been in this map. Make you a copy of a map. And then start reading in Matthew. And the first time you can determine where Jesus is at, put you a little X there on that map. Then as you just scan through the book of Matthew, every time you see Jesus at a different place, mark another spot and draw your line. So it's as if it was giving you a series of events that took place in Jesus' life, and you could follow his travels on this map. See what I'm saying? Do that for Matthew, then do it for Mark, then do it for Luke, then do it for John, and see at what point Jesus quits going to Jerusalem. I did a quick scan through Mark, and I didn't find where Jesus goes back to Jerusalem until Good Friday. He did a lot of things. The Sea of Galilee, up on a mountain, in the wilderness, by the river, or somewhere, his hometown, Capernaum. And I may have missed some. But I think what we will find is that very seldom, if ever, does Jesus go back to Jerusalem. Now, why is that? It is because the plans are there to destroy him, to take him, and he does not want to place himself in danger of his mission being cut short. Now, you say, well, wait a minute. God is sovereign. God knows the end from the beginning. God knows what's going to take place. That is true. But God most often uses human means to accomplish his end. He does it in your life, and you can see plenty of evidences where Jesus used those same natural events. He's right here in the middle of a throng. We see in verses 7 to 12. The throng is so much that they are pressed upon him. What does he do? Does he supernaturally levitate himself to get above them and then teach them? No. He does something very natural. He gets a boat. He gets in a boat so he can separate himself a little bit from the crowd. Right? This is not denying God's sovereignty. It's just saying this is the means God used. And Jesus seems to have, you can see that in a lot of instances where Jesus seemed to consciously use everyday normal things of reasoning, just like you and I would, to do what he wanted to do. All right, the last thing. Here's another one of those things. Silencing the demons. He told them, the demons, keep your mouth shut about who I am. They said, here the demons said, you're the Son of God. He says, don't tell anyone this. I think John may have had this same phrase in a sermon a few weeks ago, but when you get my age, you don't remember what John said a few weeks ago. Or at least I don't remember that. And there again, I look these things up. And that would be another one that's in that new book that somebody's going to write. All right? What in the world does he mean? Don't tell anybody. Look like he'd want people to know, doesn't he? All right? Again, there's two or three options. Number one is he doesn't want to appear to give the demons any credibility. If the demons broadcast who he is and do so correctly, then it may give them a little credibility he doesn't want them to have. Now, that's possible. Another idea that seems a little more plausible to me is that if they broadcast him now as the Son of God, then at this point, the people's understanding of what the demons would be saying is that this is the Messiah. And what they would be expecting the Messiah to do is create an overthrow of the Roman government and establish a kingdom. And that type of exposure and that type of thinking is not what Jesus wanted. Years ago, we went through the book of Matthew, and I noticed something as we went through there. Time after time, and I don't mean to say dozens of times, but five times or so, that's time after time, isn't it? A few times, Jesus would say something to his disciples, the people closest to him. And here's what he would say. He would say something like, Jesus told them how he must suffer and die. A few days and a few weeks would go by, and in another setting, in another situation, it would say, Jesus began to share with them how he must suffer. Do you know they never got it? They never got it. Until he had already suffered and died. It's very likely that what Jesus is trying to do is to put an end to the talk, to nip this in the bud, as Barney Fife would say, to nip this in the bud about a Messiah who's fixing to set up a kingdom on the earth. His time was not yet come. All right? I'm not sure of the answer to that, but that seems to be a plausible explanation, I would think. So, what do we see? From this passage, we see some things in Jesus, some things about the way Jesus reasoned, that you and I can apply, certainly not in the instances like Jesus has just applied them, but we can see them in our own lives. You and me, we can take these things. We can learn to value, and we can learn to recognize the value and to recognize the obligations of things in our lives, time, opportunity, responsibility, we can recognize that sometimes, even in our lives, acts of mercy may at times be condemning. They may expose the coldness of hearts. And thirdly, this is a proverb, isn't it? A wise man foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. I think it's Proverbs 15:3, perhaps, something somewhere in there. That's a good principle that any of us can use in our lives. A wise man sees ahead and he sees the danger, and he hides himself from the danger. But the foolish person just blows right on through, doesn't he? All right? Would you pray with me? Father, we thank you for our Savior. God, I thank you that he could be stirred and moved. Lord, I thank you that his emotions, whatever they may have been, were perfect and complete. Father, I do not doubt that, not even the slightest. Father, I desire that I might honor you. Lord, I might honor your word, that I might honor the way that it is presented, your life is presented to us. Father, would you take these scriptures, Lord, just plant them in our hearts. Father, that we may get a permanent glimpse of our Savior. Amen.